With news from Minnesota Public Radio, I'm Marisa Helms. Minneapolis police officials are thanking community groups who patrolled an area of North Minneapolis last week and credited them with reducing tensions in the area. However, the sponsors of the patrols say they will pull out of the neighborhood, which was the site of a disturbance last week when police wounded an 11-year-old boy during a drug raid. They say they're suspending the patrols because some area residents say they don't need them there. Neighborhood resident Ann Yin says the patrols weren't really necessary.
I don't think it's necessarily that they aren't welcome. I think it's more of a misunderstanding of what the mission or the purpose is. Are they specifically there just to keep peace in the neighborhood? Because that really isn't needed. Our neighborhood generally is a peaceful neighborhood.
Yin says she's not opposed to outside groups working with the neighborhood and trying to eliminate the open-air drug dealing, which occurs along the area's main corridor. The biggest spending candidate in Minnesota's race for governor isn't even in the race anymore. The latest campaign finance reports show that Orono businessman Brian Sullivan spent $2.8 million in his unsuccessful two-year quest to become Minnesota's governor. Most of Sullivan's spending came out of his own pocket. In the weather forecast today, mostly to partly cloudy, there is a chance of showers and thunderstorms. At this hour in St. Cloud, it's fair and 67 degrees, and in the Twin Cities, it's 7 degrees with overcast skies. That's the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom. I'm Marisa Helms.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening rural Minnesota communities. Online at blandinfoundation.org.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Midday. Coming to you live today from the Minnesota State Fair. I'm Gary Eichten, and if you're out here at the fair today or any day during the run of the fair, do make sure you stop by our Minnesota Public Radio booth. We are located near the corner of Judson and Nelson, just across the street from the River Raft Ride and the Gridiron Zone exhibition. Now, we should note that Rachel Reby is going to be along at noon with a special Main Street radio broadcast here on Midday, so stay tuned. This first hour, though, we're going to talk about fighting crime and preventing crime in the state of Minnesota. Joining us today here on the stage is Hennepin County Attorney Amy Klobuchar and Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gertner. They represent the two biggest counties in the state. They are both up for re-election this year, but that is a mere formality because they're both unopposed, so they're going to be in office for another 4 years. If you have a question for the county attorneys, great opportunity to find out more about how the system operates or doesn't operate. If you're here in the audience, Kate Smith is wandering around with a microphone, and she'll get a microphone to you so you can get your questions answered. There comes Kate. Those of you listening on the radio, give us a call on our traditional call-in line, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We're talking with the county attorneys this hour, and welcome back to Midday.
Well, Gary, it's great to be on. This is Amy, and I just wanted to note for your most health-conscious NPR visitors that you were serving French fries for breakfast here at the State Fair.
Well, you can't beat it with a stick,
as
they say.
It was pretty good. And and also, you mentioned that Susan and I are both unopposed, which is a nice thing to be, but it's still a formality. I think one of the most important things in election year, whether you have an opponent or not, is to get out there, talk about what you've been doing, what you plan to do in the future. I think accountability is so much a part of our election process. So we're still going to be doing that. I'm going to still be out there with some lawn signs and my plans for the next 4 years.
Well, Susan, Amy, you were on Labor Day last year out here at the fair, very popular program. But, you know, the question is, what have you done for us lately? I would think by now all the bad guys would be in the hoosegow and there'd be no need for county prosecutors.
Well, there are a lot of bad guys still out there, but Amy and I have been working on some new projects. We got a huge new task as of August 1st, and that is that we are now responsible for felony DWIs, for the prosecution of people who have committed at least four drunk driving incidents in 4 years. It's a huge new task, a really important new task that we think is going to make a big impact on public safety. It's something that Amy and Jim Backstrom and many of our colleagues in the county attorney business have been working on for years, and now it's a reality, and the cases are rolling in. I was pretty discouraged to have three or four cases already within less than a week of the new law, so it was obviously very necessary.
Is that the felony DWI law, is that going to make the roads safer?
That's the plan, and when you look at the numbers, we have over 500 people in our state with 10 or more DWIs, and while in the rest of the country in the last decade, we saw a reduction in the number of drunk driving deaths, in Minnesota, we've bucked that trend, and we've had an increase. So that's one of the reasons that we worked with a number of groups at the legislature to get this bill passed. And the idea is not just to get some of our career drunk drivers who have four or more convictions in 10 years off the streets for a while, but also to get them treatment, because so many of them, we had one guy recently arrested with 23 DWIs. So you can imagine that they're going in and out of county workhouses and they're not getting the help they need. And the idea is, and the treatment providers supported this, to not only have the stick of prison out there, but also the carrot, that if they complete treatment, if they get through this, they're not going to have to serve more prison time. So we're hopeful this is going to work. We've had 11 cases so far in Hennepin County. The first one was a boating while intoxicated, BWI. We've now had two of those. I did explain to the residents in that area that those are somewhat seasonal. We won't be seeing as many of those in December, but we are going to work hard to enforce these laws. More people are killed every year in our state by drunk drivers than they are by guns or knives or other forms of violence. And I think people don't always think that when they listen to the radio, read the newspaper, watch TV. And you have to keep in mind that a car in the hands of a drunk is just like a gun.
Washington County judge was quoted as saying the law is all fine and good, but there isn't enough money to provide the kind of intense supervision that the law envisions. And so, you know, you're arresting people, and presumably some of them could end up in prison, but there isn't really the money to provide all the services that are supposed to be part and parcel of this.
Well, there's no question that money is a big concern. In Ramsey County, we expect to have between 225 and 300 of these cases a year, and intensive supervision, really keeping track of these people, is going to be an important part of making a difference, really keeping our roads safe. And so I think that what our public policy leaders are going to have to be doing now is making sure that the programs that are really going to help are really going to make a difference are properly funded.
And people have to remember to balance that money against the cost of these incidences. Public safety, Department of Public Safety estimates over $150 million a year these drunk drivers cost us because of insurance costs, accidents, serious accidents, the cost of having them go in and out of the court system. These cases were being prosecuted before. They were simply prosecuted as misdemeanors, and now it's felony. So I think when the numbers come out in the wash, we're going to be ahead.
We're broadcasting midday today live from the Minnesota Public Radio booth out here at the Minnesota State Fair. I'm Gary Eichen, and I've been joined this hour by Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gertner and Hennepin County Attorney Amy Klobuchar. They're here to talk about crime fighting, crime prevention. Those of you, again, here in our audience at the State Fair, Kate Smith wandering around with a microphone, just raise your hand and she'll get the mic to you. If you're listening on the radio, we invite you to give us a call at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, our toll-free line is 1-800-242-2828. FBI, or the Justice Department, says that overall crime rates are going back up again after basically going down for a decade. Why is that?
Well, that is a concern. In St. Paul, I think we still have one of the safest communities for its size in the United States, but we have to keep the pressure up. I think people have talked about things like the economy in decline, less jobs available, and other kinds of things that cause criminal activity, that lead to criminal activity. We have a growing young population, youthful population, and obviously a lot of crime is committed by young people, and so it is a concern. And what particularly worries me is that in the budget problems that all kinds of levels of government are having, that there's going to be letting up of the pressure on crime. And I think that in the end, that would cost us an enormous amount of money if we reduce police, reduce prosecutors, reduce the court system because of money concerns, and we're just going to pay for it down the line.
Amy Klobuchar?
When you look at some of the neighborhoods in Minneapolis and in some of our suburban areas in Hennepin County, once crime started to go down in the last decade, you saw a corresponding increase in real estate values. You saw that the kids were going to school, that the whole quality of life got better. So there's this relationship between crime and how people are doing in their lives that's very clear. And in Minneapolis last year, we still saw a reduction in crime, which really was against the trend in the rest of the country that you mentioned, Gary, where there was an increase. This year it's pretty much level, and so while we're starting to see some very scary things going on with drugs and guns that need to be focused on immediately, we still have relatively low crime rates compared to what we had back when Minneapolis was called Murderapolis.
And Gary, I think Amy makes a real good point about the value of keeping the streets safe, and that is that you may see a modest increase in your taxes in the upcoming years to pay for public safety services, but what you're doing is protecting your investment, that your home is more valuable. If your kids can play on the yard and in the streets and walk down to the playground and that kind of thing, your home simply is going to be more valuable, and so paying for public safety is a good investment.
Let's get some audience questions involved here. Kate?
Jacqueline is from Minneapolis, and she's got a question, actually, I confess, I'm curious about, too.
How common is it for counties to have female prosecutors? I think this is marvelous.
You think this isn't the norm to have two women up there?
You're right.
Well, actually, I was thinking that the only downside of having two female county attorneys up here is we have to identify ourselves. It's Susan talking now and then switch to Amy. But it's a delight, and it is not very common. I was first elected back in 1994. And when I started attending National District Attorneys Association meetings, I was very taken aback. Oh, my gosh, that's right. This is a man's job. I forgot. And we're real pleased, I think I can speak for Amy and myself, that the Minnesota voters don't worry about gender and just pick the most qualified person.
Yeah, we have about, 5 or 7, something in that number, out of 87 counties that have women county attorneys in Minnesota. Nationally, the numbers are even worse. And when you get into big cities, it's a really small number. I think I told this story before, that at the last National District Attorneys meeting we had 2 years back in Spokane, I brought my husband, and they had an event for spouses. And the event was to go on a historic tour of the homes of Spokane, followed by tea and crumpets. And he was the only man on the trip. But it was a very good thing in the end, because he became a folk hero to many of the spouses that were on the event. And he did bring my daughter as well. So it's an area where, especially in some of the rural areas around the country, men tend to be elected, and we hope to see that change in the future.
We have some callers on the line with questions for the county attorneys. David, go ahead, please.
Oh, hello. I was calling. In reference to the treatment, they don't seem to achieve results. And it seems to be the case when people do something for the government, they don't necessarily have to achieve results because they get the money anyway. So why don't they try to revamp the treatment system so that they can get some results out of these programs that they have?
Okay.
Well, I think anyone that's dealt with an alcoholic before, I know in my own experience with my dad, sometimes people don't go through treatment just once. They go through it a few times. And one of the things that's happened with these drunk drivers is when they have served very short sentences, you have people serving, 6 months before this felony DWI, 4 months for their 20th DWI, well, they're not going to get a set treatment when they're there. And if no one's monitoring them with a felony, even if they're out on the streets, you can have probation monitor them, make sure that there's, urinalysis, you can check, you can work with drug addicts or alcoholics to make sure that they're not drinking. And you don't have that kind of check when you're dealing with a misdemeanor. So that's one of the things that we hope that we get out of this law, is better results when they do go to treatment.
Susan?
The other thing to keep in mind is that no matter how many times it takes drunk driver to get through treatment to be successful in the end, no matter how many dollars are spent, you're still going to end up ahead of the game. I mean, I don't remember the exact figure, but there's just an enormous bang for your buck when you talk about treatment versus not treating someone and having them continue to go through the criminal justice system and continue to commit crimes. So you do get a lot of value, even though I can understand the frustration of people like the caller watching it take sometimes 4, 5, 6, 7 times before it hits.
Is the biggest problem people who are in fact chemically dependent or the average Joe has too many drinks one night and goes out driving around?
Well, this is Amy. The average Joe that goes drinking out a few times, maybe he'll get one DWI. What we're talking about here are people that have 4 or more DWIs. There was a guy who said he moved here from Colorado because they had a felony DWI law, and he decided, he is an alcoholic, but that he'd move here so then he wouldn't have to go to prison as long a time if he got picked up. That is a thought process that we're hoping to turn around with this law, because some of these drunk drivers, many of them don't have felonies on their record. Felony's a big deal. It means you can't vote. It means you're not going to get certain jobs. And there's an incentive. Many of them have jobs. They don't want to have a felony. They don't want to go to prison. That will be created with this law.
And they don't want to lose their right to carry the firearms.
That's right.
That was a huge part of the debate.
A big part of the debate in Greater Minnesota was the issue about whether if someone had 20 DWIs and they were convicted of a felony, would that be fair to make it a felony because they would lose their right to have a firearm? And ultimately, the legislature decided with some persuasion that it was, in fact, a good idea not to have people with 20 DWIs out there with guns. And so that law is now in place, that it's a felony after you've had 4 DWIs.
We're broadcasting live today from the Minnesota State Fair. Our guests, Hennepin County Attorney Amy Klobuchar, Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gertner is here, and we're here to talk about crime fighting, crime prevention, whatever questions you have on your mind. Those of you here in the audience, Kate Smith over here with the black T-shirt is wandering around with a mic, so just get her attention and she'll get a microphone to you. Those of you listening on the radio, give us a call, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. Chris, you're next. Go ahead, please.
Hi. A couple of weeks ago, crossing in a crosswalk, I almost got hit by a driver. Went right through the stop sign, turned right in front of me, had to jump out of the way. That driver proceeded down my street, ran a red light, and then parked. I called 911. Nothing. We can do nothing for you. Called crime prevention. Nothing we can do for you. Called my husband, who is an attorney. He called the city attorney's office. We have bigger fish in the sea to take care of than that. Now, if I had been pushing my 2-year-old son in the stroller in front of me, he would be dead today. I tried to make a citizen arrest, and I got nowhere until I had to get my attorney husband involved. I'd like to know, the streets in Minneapolis for walkers are unsafe, even when we are following the laws, crossing at stop signs, waiting for the lights to cross the street. People run red lights, they go right through the stop signs, they drive recklessly. What are we going to do about this? That's a basic safety issue.
All right,
yeah,
thanks,
this
Chris.
Is Amy, and that sounds like a crime to me. It's most likely not in my office. It's not a felony crime unless someone had been hurt, but it's or the driver was drunk, but it is a misdemeanor crime to violate those kinds of traffic laws. Maybe after the show, you can call back and I can give my name and I'll try to help you out with the city attorney's office. Of course, the police have to have the defendant in order to pursue that. We have to have the name of the person that did that. And again, this gets back to the idea that I think back in the old days, these driving violations, whether people were drunk or just driving like maniacs, they were just thought of, I guess that's just the way people drive. And more we've come to realize that this is a huge public safety risk. We just had a case in the office last week with a juvenile who did, it was conduct very similar to what the caller described, went through a park driving a car. And in this case, I couldn't believe the irony because this is exactly what happened in this case. He had his kids in front of him and this car swooped through the park and almost hit his kids. This was a juvenile case, but he came in and he gave a victim impact statement to the judge, and there were some consequences there to that driver, even though no one had been hurt. And I think we need to start taking these cases seriously. The reason we had that case is that it involved a juvenile, and we handle all juvenile cases in both Susan and Ramsey and myself in Hennepin County, whether it be a small case or a bigger felony case.
Susan, care to comment?
Well, I think that what it points out is that our streets need to be safe in all kinds of ways, and that the focus of the criminal justice system in the last few years has been to work on quality of life crimes, like what happens with drivers, what happens that, you know, maybe doesn't rise to the level of the high-profile murder or the rape or things like that, but that we got to enforce all the laws because they all make a difference in terms of how comfortable we are being in the community.
Tom, your question, please.
Klobuchar, I want to know what she's going to do about the Minneapolis Police Department and police brutality. I know in my situation, coming out of the Basilica block party, I was severely beaten by the Minneapolis Police Department officers for absolutely doing nothing, just not getting out of the way fast enough. And I've had a bunch of friends that suffered the same abuse by the Minneapolis police. And I think there's a real problem. Okay. And I want to know what she is going to do about it.
First of all, do you agree it's a real problem?
Well, I do think that we've had some, I think it's no secret to anyone that there's been some recent issues in the community highlighting that there's a lot of tension there in certain neighborhoods. I think that certain, a lot of people in the community would say the police have been great help to us in our neighborhood, crimes down, we like our police officers, and in other parts there's a lot of distrust. And I know that's something that Mayor Rybak and Chief Olson in Minneapolis have made really their number one priority, is to build that trust up again by more involvement with the community. As I know that Mayor Rybak is working on setting up a new civilian review board, so complaints like the one that you have made have a vehicle, have a place to be brought to where people feel that there's some kind of a meaningful process that they can go through. From our office's perspective, we enforce the law down the line. We have a case in the office right now involving a police officer and a charge of a sexual assault involving a young woman. That case is going through the court process, and we are being very aggressive in pursuing that case. I think it's very important while we our partnership with the police is so important at all county attorney's offices. In the end, we also have to enforce the law, even if it involves a police officer. So I'm very impressed by the work that the mayor is trying to do, that the chief is trying to do, that really the community groups in the Jordan neighborhood and others are trying to do to keep that trust there. Because in the end, if that trust breaks down, it's the people in the neighborhoods that are hurt the most. If there's no police protection for them, or they don't trust the people that are there protecting them, you're just not going to have the kind of protection you need. So I see hope in what's going on, and I hope the caller will see that hope and pursue what's going on with that reporting process so he can find out if he wants to file any kind of a charge.
Susan Gardner, do you get the sense that there is enough being done to make sure the police operate on the up and up, and when there is an incident of some sort, that it is fairly investigated?
Well, I've been a prosecutor in Ramsey County for now 18 years. Even saying that makes me feel old, but I do feel like I've got a lot of experience dealing with the St. Paul Police Department and the community, and I've always felt very fortunate that the St. Paul Police Department has such a good relationship with the community it serves and really has the confidence of the community it serves, and it really makes a difference in terms of the work as a prosecutor that I do. Whether or not we do enough, I mean, you can always do more. I mean, I think that very simply put, communication needs to be constant, and I know that Chief Finney and his predecessors have worked hard on that. I mean, you just need to be talking one-on-one with people about the issues involving the police. I think that I've always felt that St. Paul is really just a big, small town, and maybe that's a factor. People know each other, and I think that helps build confidence when something does occur.
So we're a small, big town.
Well,
Dick's on the line. Quick question, Dick, before we break for news.
been arrested for beating up the reporters and setting the cars on fire? Has there been any arrest of the citizens in that neighborhood that caused the problem?
This is Amy answering your question. The investigation is continuing in that area. I know that reports have been filed, police reports involving the reporters that were injured. We have filed one charge against someone who had a gun at the scene in the house where the search warrant was executed with that endangered children because the gun was there. And when those cases come to us, we will bring those charges when they come to us. But we don't have the cases in the office, and we would also have to review them and make sure the evidence is there. I always tell people it's like the Law and Order TV show. The first half an hour, the police investigate the crime, and then it comes to the prosecutor's offices. So we don't get involved in that investigation stage. We review the evidence when the police brings them.
If it only
it to
took
us.
A half an hour each, wouldn't that
right.
be great?
But then, you know, people always ask me, well, then who are you on that show? And I used to always say, well, I'm that old guy that sits on the couch
yeah, right.
and says, no, you can't do that. But now he's been replaced by a woman, right,
well,
Susan?
Except now he's been replaced again. I mean,
yeah.
Well,
anyway.
With a man.
Exactly.
Oh, well.
This is Midday coming to you from the Minnesota State Fair. We're out here at the Minnesota Public Radio booth near the corner of Judson and Nelson. And if you're out at the fair, do make sure you stop by, take a look at the goodies that are for sale. And I think we have drawings. Don't we have a drawing to win a bet or something? So get in on that. Do stop by. We're going to take a break here for headlines, but those of you here in the audience, Kate's standing by with a microphone, so get her attention. If you have a question for our county attorneys, those of you listening on the radio, give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Our guests this hour, Hennepin County Attorney Amy Klobuchar and Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gertner. We'll continue our conversation right after this break.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio is supported by the Blandin Foundation, committed to strengthening rural Minnesota communities. Online at blandinfoundation.org.
It's word of mouth, pass it on.
It's word of mouth, pass it on.
It's heard down south, pass it on.
It's third in sprouts, pass it on.
It's loved by louts, pass it on.
It screams and shouts, pass it on.
It smiles and pouts, pass it on.
There's wrestling touts, pass it on.
It's Plagued by Doubts, a radio guide to the arts, every Friday night at 6 and 11, and on the web at minnesotapublicradio.org. Pass it on.
All right, we're back here at the Minnesota State Fair. I'm Gary Eichten, Midday coming to you from the fair. By the way, while I think of it, today, of course, we're at our booth, the Minnesota Public Radio booth near the corner of Judson and Nelson. Tomorrow has been officially designated Minnesota Public Radio Day at the fair. Not entirely sure that you get free Pronto Pups or anything like that if you're a member, but we are going to do some special programming from the Carousel Park, which is up by the grandstand. So hope you can come by, among other things. Tomorrow on Midday, we're going to have two candidate debates. At 11 o'clock, all the U.S. Senate candidates will be getting together. And at noon, then, all the candidates for governor will be here to take people's questions. So that should be interesting, and we hope you'll be able to stop by. Today, we're at the booth. We're talking crime fighting, crime prevention. Our guests, Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gertner and Hennepin County Attorney Amy Klobuchar. And lots of people with questions. Before we get back to the phones, though, I do have a question about Amy Klobuchar. You had a press conference this morning, and I know, Susan Gertner, you've been involved in this as well. This whole issue of truancy, getting kids to go to school, it seems like a fairly parochial issue for a big-time county prosecutor to be involved with.
Well, I think it's the best way. I wouldn't call it parochial because it's probably the number one way we can get kids out of crime. And you know, we're not like a business. We don't like to see repeat customers. And when we look at the records of these kids that get in serious trouble, one of the things that immediately jumps out at you is that they first get in trouble when they're missing school. It doesn't mean they don't have other things going on in their lives and hard family lives, they do. But when they start missing school and they get off that track, they really start getting in trouble with the law. And one of the things that we did, and I know Susan has done wonderful work with this as well, is we started working with all the superintendents in our county, in the suburban areas, in Minneapolis, to come up with what works. And we focused on, one, keeping attendance, making sure these any parent knows you got to watch kids, and they know if they're not being watched. Two, early intervention, when they have a number of unexcused absences, the school's going in there, meeting with them, meeting with the parents, signing contract about what they want to do differently. And three, if it does come to the courthouse, to make sure that that process moves quickly. So today, we announced some good results countywide, particularly in Minneapolis. 3 years ago when we started this, less than 50% of the kids were there 95% of the time, and now we're up to two-thirds. In the elementary school level, where it's so critical, and I know Susan can talk about some of the work she's been doing in this area, we saw a big jump up to 77% of the kids there, a 95% of the time, 13% increase over 3 years ago. And that is where the patterns are set. If those kids, the superintendent in Minneapolis, Carol Johnson, talked about it this morning, if those kids by the age of 9 aren't into that pattern of going to school every day, aren't reading by third grade, then it's going to be very difficult to get them back on that track in later years. So that's been a major focus in both of our counties, is to keep those young people in school. And while it was great results today and encouraging, there's still a lot more work to be done.
Susan Gardner.
Gary, I love the way you said that, something about big-time county attorneys, why would you worry about keeping kids in school? That's exactly why I think these programs work. We started our truancy intervention program back in 1995, and literally thousands of kids have gone through it and dramatically improved attendance. And I think it is in part because it sends a strong message. If you get a letter from the county attorney saying, we're paying attention and your kid has got to be in school and these are the consequences if they're not, I think people do pay attention. I think it sends a powerful message to a child to know that the same county attorney's office that's prosecuting the drive-by shooting down the street cares that he's been skipping school or she's been skipping school. So I think that it's a good message to send, that education really matters.
And it's important to note, it's not a crime. Truancy's not a crime. A kid isn't going to go to prison. So if you see a kid out there and you know that they should be in school, if you know their parents, you should call their parents. If you know the school, you should call the school. In the end, you can even call the police. And in Minneapolis, they'll take this child to the Truancy Curfew Center that's run by the Urban League. They won't get a criminal record, but someone is going to be watching over them and know they're gone keep track of them. And I think that's a real important thing to remember about this issue.
And Amy just said that the child is not going to go to prison if they're not in school. But one of the problems is if they're not in school today, the chances are a lot higher that they're going to be in prison down the line. 71% of our nation's prison population never finished high school. Educational failure is a huge predictor of social problems down the line. So there might be not an immediate consequence, but the long-term consequences for all of us are great if our kids aren't in school.
And Gary, I remember I was on this topic show one other time, and someone actually called in and said, you know, this just sounds so draconian. To say that you're going to do something to a kid. I love taking my kid out. I take her to museums. I take her to concerts. And I finally said, you know, let's get real. These kids are not at Orchestra Hall. They are not at the Guthrie Theater when this is happening. They're out on the street corners. They're victims of crime. They're getting pregnant. This is what's happening. And as a community, we can't turn our backs on these kids. We have to have higher expectations for them.
Kate Smith, you have a question, or an audience member with a question, right?
Yes, Carol is from St. Paul. You know, Susan and Amy, I've been pondering this for a couple of weeks now, so you're going to be victimized for a second. Can you tell me what would be the difference between a riot, a melee, a demonstration, and what was that other one that I, an incident? I'm chaining off of an article in the Popular Press just this Monday or Tuesday, where there was a perspective on the part of the writer that there was a reluctance to call what went on in North Minneapolis a riot.
I did see that article, and boy, I don't have any easy answers, and I think that if you want to look at it in a positive way, I think the thing to do is understand the power of words. And if maybe people go a little too far in one direction in terms of saying the right thing, maybe that's not the worst thing. I mean, the fact is that words like riot carry an enormous connotation. And for some people, it's a racist term. And so it's very, very dicey. I wouldn't begin to give you definitions. And I certainly wouldn't begin to tell the popular press how to characterize things.
I think of it sort of from a boring legal response.
There we go.
Which we can always resort to with difficult questions.
Well, Amy, before
the answer, there is there are laws that says about rioting and that those kinds of things can be illegal depending on what the conduct is. But as I've said before in answer to another question, the police are still investigating what went on there, and we have not had any cases except the one I mentioned that have come into our office.
In my experience, okay. There's riots, melees, and political conventions, and it's hard to distinguish.
What about that wedding reception up in North Minneapolis where they were throwing Jello or something?
Amy, you can take. I don't know what the laws are in Hennepin County on Jello.
I have to tell you, I wasn't aware of that, but I just hope it didn't occur at any of my relatives' homes. Yeah. But anyway, that would not be the kind of case that we usually see in our office. I don't think we've had Jello as a dangerous weapon that I've seen. But clearly, I think what you're getting at too, and I did not read this article, but the issue of words, as Susan mentioned, is very important. And to some people, that's one of the things in our jobs is that we're very careful when we talk to victims of crime, when we talk to people in the community, to carefully explain, using the law, whether something's a crime or not. And there can be things that happen to people that are really bad in their lives, and babies can die, and sometimes it's a crime, and sometimes it's a tragic accident. And so it's very important in our line of business that we use those words carefully. So I wish we could answer your question better, but I hope we gave you some insight.
Let's go back to the phones. Lydia's on the line with a question for the county attorneys. Lydia.
Hi. Yes. And I guess I'm sort of continuing some of this dialogue that's been going, and that is I'm kind of confused about gun possession laws, because my understanding is you are allowed to have a legally registered handgun in your home, and it makes no sense to me that the shooting incident on the north side that predicated this uproar, that the grandmother would be charged with reckless endangerment when in fact it was the police who shot this 11-year-old boy. I should say I'm white, but I would think that our African-American citizens are allowed to have a legally registered handgun in their home like anybody else. So I would like you to address this bizarre contradiction that the police shoot first without thinking when there's lots of people around, but it's the grandma of this child who has been charged with the crime. Anybody who wonders why this incident took place, that people got kicked off and got in the streets, here's one reason why. These kinds of contradictions.
Okay, thank you, Lydia. Well, there are two issues there. Number one, before we get to the issue of the woman possessing a handgun, is it fair to characterize what happened last week as a case of the police shooting first and thinking later?
Well, this is Susan, and I'm going to jump in here because it's very difficult for county attorneys to talk about cases that are ongoing in their jurisdictions, and so I'm not going to comment on the specifics of this case. But one thing that the caller should understand is that under the law, yes, you can lawfully possess a weapon in your home. One of our major concerns as county attorneys is not people lawfully possessing those guns, but felons who possess those guns illegally, and we put a lot of effort into that kind of thing, taking guns out of the hands of people who have committed crimes and therefore are more dangerous. If a child is in the house, parents certainly have a responsibility to keep that lawfully possessed gun out of the hands of children. I mean, unfortunately, lots of kids die every year from accidental shootings because guns were carelessly left around. And so the law does protect children by making it a crime to, say, keep a loaded weapon within easy access of a child. So that's where the endangerment can come in.
And while I can't comment on this specific case, I can say that we have prosecuted white people for endangering children's lives by having loaded guns in homes. We've had one unfortunate case before my time involving someone who was prosecuted when their child picked up the gun and shot themselves. So these cases while rare, are out there, and we're going to continue to diligently enforce these gun laws. That's been one of the good things that's been going on in the last few years, is taking seriously gun violations. It's really one of the best tools that we can use to keep our streets safe. There's a mandatory minimum in Minnesota that Susan was talking about with felons in possessions of guns, 5-year mandatory minimum that we've made as one of our number one priorities to enforce those laws, to make sure that we do everything we can to get guns out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them.
In general, are the police careful enough in the when they discharge their firearms, or do they tend to blast away sometimes when they shouldn't?
Well, fortunately, in St. Paul and Ramsey County, we haven't had very many police shooting citizens. And when those things happen, they are carefully reviewed by the criminal justice system. We routinely take shootings into a grand jury, citizens of the county, to take a look at whether or not the use of force was appropriate. And I think there are very significant protections.
And that's not something that we are required to do by law. That's something that we think is important for the community, that when the police shoot someone and someone is killed, that case is reviewed by citizens out in the community to determine whether or not criminal charges should be brought.
Kate, another question from the audience?
Yes, Paul is up from Walnut Grove at the State Fair.
Thank you. Just a comment. Being from Walnut Grove, to a small town in southwest Minnesota, and I know rural issues are a little different, obviously, than urban issues in a case like this, but in terms of crime, but we do have it. But it strikes me, just listening to you and the kind of programs you try and institute in the cities, that anonymity is something that we do not have in small town Minnesota. And it seems to work extremely well in terms of keeping crime from happening, because people are out there even trying to help, you know, whoever is involved in some way, or at least they're aware of them and they stay their distance, or they know who to talk to.
So we
live in a fishbowl.
Yeah, this is Amy, and I think what's interesting about what you just said is that exact model is what we've been trying to emulate with some of the work we've been doing with community prosecution, where you have a lawyer assigned not just to do auto theft cases in the whole county with 45 municipalities, but to a certain area. We have one juvenile community prosecutor now for Bloomington. We have another for Brooklyn Park. We have someone for each precinct in Minneapolis for property crimes. And what happens is they get to know that community. They may not know everyone like you would know in a Walnut Grove, but they know the principals at the school, they know some of the kids, they know some of the parents, they get to know the police. So there's that kind of relationship and responsibility that really builds for better trust with the community. And that's what the idea of community policing is to try to assign officers to certain areas. And it's really bringing back that small town idea and trying to put that idea into a big city. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
And also, I know there's been some more crime. I mean, there's been some issues out in greater Minnesota that are need to be addressed as well. And we're starting to see some of the problems that we see in the city. And so anything that we can do to help in that area, we're ready to do it.
Just to add that it's the fact that there's no anonymity out there. And that seems to be a deterrent.
Mm-hmm. I said before that St. Paul is really just a big, small town. And obviously, I'm not talking about the lack of anonymity at the level you're talking about in Walnut Grove. But what I have seen, and as I said before, I've been doing this now for 18 years, is the biggest change in being a prosecutor 18 years ago and being a prosecutor now is the community support. I mean, when we were doing our work 18 years ago, there weren't the block clubs, there weren't the community groups, there wasn't the kind of feeling that we're all in here, this together, that we get now. The neighborhood groups, the neighborhood activists, the community groups, the block clubs are making a huge difference by being involved and trying to get rid of some of the anonymity that we see in our neighborhoods, and it's critical to public safety. Unfortunately, it's one of the first things to go, though, when we have these budget crises that I was talking about before, is programs like community prosecution, which Amy has done very successfully and we've been doing for years, is the first thing to get the axe, because it isn't seen as important.
Let me change subjects, if I may. Do you folks get involved in Enron-type cases? Can we expect, you know, some scion of industry to be hauled off to the Hooskow with Susan Gertner or Amy Klobuchar kind of pushing the guy down the street?
You mean that perp walk? Like they've actually, we had someone call us the other day, someone from the media, not from NPR, and say, are you going to do a perp walk? The person, because they've been watching these Enron things.
They've been watching too much TV,
I think
too.
So. No, we don't do that. But the what we are seeing is more and more white-collar cases, and I've been saying this for about a year, and then this is before Enron. I was pleased to see there was a big story in the front page of the New York Times saying white-collar cases were on the rise. Some of this is the economy. Some of this, as I mentioned to Gary earlier, because of Enron, a lot of small businesses started auditing their books this year and doing special audits, new audits, and guess what they found? They were getting embezzled by some of their employees. So we've actually had a number of cases that came out of that. We also, because the U.S. Attorney's Office, FBI, is spending time on terrorism and those kinds of cases, we're seeing now more at the local level that might have been federal in the past. And so we've really beefed up. That's the one area that we've beefed up in our office. We've changed some resources around to make sure we can respond to these white-collar cases. They're incredibly more resource-intensive. You got to look at documents. You're not talking about a crowbar. You're talking about a computer. And so we're ready to do that. And law enforcement needs to get as sophisticated as the crooks that are committing these crimes. It's a race issue as well. If we don't go after these crimes, if we do not go after a judge that steals $400,000 from a mentally retarded woman, or go after some Northwest Airlines pilots that steal over $1 million by claiming they live in a post office box in Florida instead of $1 million house in the Twin Cities, and these are two cases that you know have been in our office, if we don't do that, how can we prosecute an African American or anyone of any race for street crime? And so I think that you need to have that to have justice, to make sure that you're going after these white collar cases, just like you go after the street crime.
Susan Gertner?
Well, certainly we have an involvement in white collar crime. As Amy said, as the U.S. attorneys get more and more involved in terrorism and those issues, more and more that is going to fall on our plate. A related issue is cybercrime, something we're very, very concerned about. The use of computers by crooks is pretty daunting as a public safety issue, because it's very complex. The cases are very difficult, but it is a brand new tool for crooks to embezzle, to steal, to do all kinds of things. And so it's something that we're having to keep up on.
Let me ask you another question, one that I've always wanted to ask somebody who knows the answer. When do you folks convene a grand jury as opposed to just bringing charges against people? What's the point of a grand jury?
Well, the grand jury is a very important part of the criminal justice system. The most common time we convene a grand jury is when there's been a murder. If someone commits a homicide, a murder, we cannot charge them with first-degree murder, the top-of-the-line murder charge, without a grand jury process, without an indictment from a grand jury. And so when we're leveling the most serious charge possible in our criminal justice system, we have to have citizens of the county tell us that the evidence is there and that we should go forward. Another way we use grand juries very frequently is if we're not quite sure whether or not the evidence would be sufficient to go forward with the case, what the community sentiment is on a case, if it's kind of a difficult one. And so they're an important pulse, if you will, of the community that we can take. Because when we do have enormous power, and we take that power very seriously and try to exercise it very judiciously, you know, we don't want to file charges if we don't think that the evidence is sufficient, and sometimes we need citizens to tell us if we've got what we need.
One of the most helpful ways we used the grand jury in the last few years was a case where it was a 23-year-old murder where a man had hired someone to burn down the building and two firefighters were killed, and there was never enough evidence, so we brought that case to the grand jury and used it to get these witnesses that had, you know, heard things 23 years ago that they had tried to hire them to burn down the building too, and we were able to get an effective amount of evidence that we could then go through use to indict and ultimately the man pled guilty to that 23-year-old murder. And so that would be an example not of when we're required to do it, as Susan pointed out, but the second time we use it, when for some reason we need it for investigation, or perhaps, as she mentioned, for cases which are we need that to get that kind of input from the citizenry.
And Gary, another time we use grand juries in Ramsey County is when we have election law cases. I think one thing that maybe isn't commonly known is how much responsibility county attorneys have to keep the playing field level, to keep people following the law in that rough and tumble world of politics. And a lot of times we get candidates screaming at each other, you violated the law, you violated the law, and it's in our laps then, and a lot of times we take those cases to a grand jury to see what they think we should do with them.
So remember, don't vote twice in this election, or you may be seeing us.
We've only got about 30 seconds left. If somebody wants to be the next Amy Klobuchar, Susan Gertner, want to be a county attorney, what's the first thing they should do?
Well, you have to put up about 3,000 lawn signs and go to 85 pancake breakfasts and 29 parades. So if anyone's interested, that's the first thing you do. No, I think that the challenge of this job and the great part about this job is the impact you can have on people's everyday lives. You're right out there in the front line working with families, working with people. And I think that interest, to have that kind of interest in changing policy, is important.
Well, what I think that did the most for me in terms of getting into this job was spending 10 years in the trenches trying cases, rapes, robberies, burglaries, really working directly with victims and their pain and getting justice for them. And I think that that really helped prepare me for what I'm doing.
We're out of time. Thanks so much for coming by.
Well, it was great to be here, and I love the man on the stick, a guy on stilts out there, and he has a big sign, and it says, Man on a Stick. Come out to the fair. You'll see it.
Hennepin County Attorney Amy Klobuchar, Ramsey County Attorney Susan Gertner here for the first hour of Midday.